I'm George Oriella from the University of Warwick, and I'm here with Professor Diamond Screech, who is Professor of the History of Art at SOAS and Head of the School of Art. And we are in front of a painting that looks to me Japanese, but it has also some familiar features that look very Western.
Yes, so what we see is a large piece of silk, which is a traditional East Asian support for a painting. It's about a meter or so high, and then obviously about two-thirds of a meter wide. In other words, it's a fairly substantial painting, but it's something for a domestic space. So no doubt this would have been owned by a wealthy Edo merchant class person, could have been an elite person, but in a more casual sort of room. It is therefore entirely Japanese insofar as it's a painting done on silk. It can be rolled up and stored away in the manner of the Japanese painting. But what's not Japanese about it is the way that it actually looks. It's done in the Western style, and that is striking. There are various moments in Japanese history when the Western style became of interest. And one of the big moments was when Japan first encountered Europe, mostly through Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian missionaries, round about the year 1580. But this is not from that early period. That period is associated with Christianity, which was subsequently made illegal in Japan, and contact with Europe was certainly not closed off completely, but much restricted. After that, around 1780s, so almost 200 years on, there was another surge of interest in Europe and Japan. And that happened partly for political reasons, that the shogun himself was a very intellectual and inquisitive person, which was not always the case with shoguns. It was hereditary, and sometimes there were good ones, sometimes there were bad ones. But in the middle of the 18th century, there was a very interesting figure called Yoshimune, and he clarified the situation with regard to imported works, both artistic works and also intellectual works like books and scientific things. And he said that so long as there was no Christian content, anything Western could be imported into Japan. And so things then come in large quantities. The agent of imports is the Dutch East India Company, which had been operating in Japan right from that earlier period, but had been very apprehensive about bringing to Japan anything which might render their Japanese contacts suspect of being Christian and therefore being imprisoned or even killed. So from the second half of the 18th century, the Dutch East India Company themselves start to bring things which they think will be desirable presents for the Japanese, artistic objects. So the East India Company itself never trades in art, but they need bribes, presents, gifts, and sailors are always given a trunk which they can bring their own objects for sale. So Western objects are not probably really high art, but little pictures, printed books, prints, topographical views all come into Japan. So from that period, say the second half of the 18th century, the second time of interest in Europe, we call this the age of Rangaku. That's a Japanese word that we used at the time. Ran is short for Oranda, or Holland, and gaku means study or learning. So Dutch studies or European studies is how it's translated into English. And the artist who made this work is one of the great figures in that Rangaku movement. The painting is signed, although it's a little difficult to see in details. He signed it in Roman letters. He didn't sign it with his Japanese characters. He signed it with Roman letters. So he's clearly affiliating himself by this work with a Western painting idiom, even though, as I began by saying, in some ways it's entirely Japanese work. It would be displayable in Japanese context.
Are there other works of art that are signed? Do we know about a community of painters, or is he unique in producing this kind of work?
Kōkan is rather special because he was quite gifted as a painter, as you, I think, can see. He'd trained as a Japanese style artist before encountering Western art. He was a townsperson, of townsperson class, and this is crucial in early modern Japan, where there's a division between the samurai class, the warrior class, and the townspeople, and it's quite difficult for those two groups to meet each other in normal social surroundings. So we get the rise within Rangaku itself of a samurai class cohort and a townsperson class cohort. And the townspeople, although they're of lower social status, they're actually much freer. And they're not subject to all kinds of status protocols and obligations. So Kokan was somebody who could work as a professional artist, he could sell his paintings to people who wanted them, he could travel around and see things, and that's indeed exactly what he did. What makes him special is that he actually went from Edo, the capital, modern-day Tokyo, where he was born and lived, all the way down to Nagasaki, which was the only open port. And somebody of high status couldn't have made that trip. I mean, you have status obligations that don't let you wander the countryside. But he could do that. And he left a diary of his trip, which is extremely interesting. This painting is not dated, so we can't tell if it's before or after his trip to Nagasaki, but likely it's after, because he seems to have really been quite familiar with the Western style. So he went on his trip in 1788, and he arrived back home again about 18 months later, so it was a long trip. But going from Edo, Tokyo, to Nagasaki on foot would take you a month or 6 weeks, so he went down there and then had the best part of a year living and then came back. He said that he funded his trip down to Nagasaki. He had no assets other than his money he got for his paintings. So he funded his trip by making topographical views in the Western style of Edo itself. So as he's traveling through the countryside in remote areas of Japan, the people he encounters probably couldn't care less about the West. They've never heard of it. But they're terribly interested by their own famous capital city, the biggest city in the world at that time, a million people. They want to know what it looks like. And he finds it useful to use the Western style to produce, as it were, realistic views of his hometown. And he shows these to people in the evenings when he's in an inn. People give him money to see them. And that way he funds his trip.
Well, that's a great, great story. And what does this painting represent?
It's a landscape view, clearly. We have in the forefront two birds sitting on a wintry tree, and then there's a deeply recessed river view leading to what seems to be some sort of wharf and a castle in the background. It's obviously a Western view. It doesn't depict anywhere, but to a Japanese viewer it shows this foreign place. So here Kokan is certainly not showing his hometown for regional people. Mm-hmm. He's probably got back to Edo, he's in artistic circles, and he's showing his newfound discoveries after his year in Nagasaki of all the things he's learned from actually meeting Western people, but also Chinese. One should remember that a lot of Western things come into Japan via China. It's not always directly from Europe. So he's produced a painting of a sort of generic Western view. He's very clearly used perspective. He's very clearly used coloured waters and skies, which was very striking to a Japanese viewer. Waters and skies are never painted in East Asian art. And he's used shadows. And this is always what was said by people at the time when they encountered Western art. It's the shadows, it's the colours, it's the perspective. So that's really the point of the picture. On the right-hand side, for example, very deep shadows under the tree. The left-hand bird seems to be casting a shadow with its legs. It's a little bit illogical, perhaps, but he clearly has made shadows. The wintry, lowering sky you might get in a Dutch picture, but the winter sky doesn't look so different in Japan anyway. But it's not just a view of birds on a tree. The ornithological interest is present as well as the Western style, but even then it's not just a picture of birds in a Western landscape. What he's done is rather cleverly grafted a traditional Japanese painting theme onto a Western manner, because the display of works of art in Japan, certainly the display of paintings, was very seasonal. Any normal household would have a storehouse with many works of art in it, and you'd bring out works and display them as appropriate to the season. Normally, paintings should depict the season. You would never display a work out of season. For example, the Primavera, Botticelli's Primavera, hung up for 300 years. That could not be done in Japan. You'd take it away when spring had finished and bring it out again. So this painting would be made for display in winter. And so to that extent, it has a purpose in the Japanese interior. It complements the winter season. But the painting of birds on wintry trees is a specific and recognized winter theme. There are others as well, but this is a well-known one. They call it the cold bird on a withered tree. or since Japanese has no singular or plural, cold birds on withered trees, withered in the sense of having died back for winter. So if you wanted to assign a title to this painting, mm-hmm. it entirely fits with normal Japanese mode. You could have Shibakokan, cold bird on a withered tree, in a catalogue, and you'd have no suspicion that it had any Western influence in it at all. So Kokan, and this is something we see repeatedly in his work, he's not just interested in some sort of exotic interest in the West. There were people who felt that. They just wanted to show a view of Holland or a view of Rome or something that made people think, like, how amazing, in the same way that Shinwasari Japanese sometimes was purely about exoticism. Kokan, I think, is more interested in Western art as a different structural system for making pictures, which he, living at the end of the 18th century, more than 200 years into the existence of the Tokugawa shogunal regime, he's lived in a somewhat static social environment, that he's wanting to see how can art change, how can art say things and be things that we haven't seen before. But he doesn't just want to say, let's throw everything over and let's become Western-style artists. He's not interested in that. He wants to know, what can Western art give us to reinvigorate our own painting modes? So nobody would have displayed this unless they were interested in Western art. That's obviously the thing that most strikes you about it. But equally, it's not there just to make you think, oh wow, how different. It's to say, we in Japanese art depict the seasons. It's important to represent the seasons in a way which is striking and exciting and meaningful. But we've become too formulaic in our own systems over the generations. Let's see how we can change. And so this is both novel and also at the same time strangely classical.
Tell me one thing, Timon, about the Western influence in this period that is seen as a period of closure to Western, surely Western presence in Japan. How common, how well accepted was it, and how well accepted would have been a painting like this?
The claims of Japan being in a state of national isolation is the term that's often used, is dramatically overstated. Of course, Japan is very far from Europe. Japan didn't actually have a lot of things that Europe wanted, nor did Europe have that many things that Japan wanted. So trade was always going to be small between Japan and Europe. But still, the Dutch East India Company sent at least two ships every year. They're quite substantial ships with about 80 to 100 sailors on board. So these ships would bring a lot. What was different about it from previous and also subsequent ages was that foreigners weren't allowed just to wander around the country. The time of, which I mentioned earlier, 1580s to about 1610, where there's intensive missionary work in Japan, foreigners are permitted to wander over the countryside at will. This is regarded as too politically destabilizing. So in Kokan's day, things come into Japan from Europe, and from China, and from Korea, Thailand, and India, of course, as well, but very few people. So when Kokan wanted to encounter foreigners, he had to go to Nagasaki to do it. And because we have his diary, we have records of him actually having gone into the Dutch East India Company trading compound and met people there. He said he drank wine, he talked to people, he sat on chairs, and he then spent some weeks in the town. He couldn't live with the foreigners. They have a stockaded enclosure that Japanese can't stay the night in. But he was able to make friends with one of the government translators. The shogunate has several hereditary families of translators working with Dutch books, but also just the trading logs and things. And he meets one of those who is himself a quite famous intellectual. And Kokan leads his lovely story about he spent the night drinking and talking about Europe with this man. He said that his walls were covered with English paintings. Interestingly, he specifically mm-hmm. says they're English paintings. And he got drunk and he couldn't go home. He spent the night sort of, as it were, on the sofa. And when he woke up in the morning, he painted a portrait of this translator to thank him. Mm-hmm. And that portrait is also a rather well-known painting by Shibakokan, showing this distinguished elderly translator bureaucrat sitting in a formal position, and flying above his head are angels in the manner of the Western mm-hmm. apotheosis. There's another case where he's taken the very traditional Japanese gentlemanly friendship portrait, absolutely standard thing, but he's grafted onto it something Western too.
That's a brilliant story with which we can conclude of including the angels on top of one set. Thank you so much, Diamond.
Thank you very much.